the parity system that was legislated at the end of 1941 when the U.S. went into the Second World War. So it's an historical document that seems to, I feel, has some weight, some importance to it. And the part that we, just a quick recap, last week we read the introduction and everything, and we got to the part about saying, well, our country has plenty of people to work, we have plenty of resources and marvelous technology to do things, yet our potential is unfulfilled. There are people whose needs are not met, and there are people who are not finding work. And the question the pamphlet asks is why? Then it gives... It says the reason is because there is a bottleneck in the circulation of money. That it isn't that there's not enough money, but that the money can't circulate right. And then it gives an analogy about if all the money were in a reservoir like a bathtub, and the water in a bathtub can't get out and scoop the way you want it to, well, you remount the plumbing. And so it's suggesting that there needs to be some changes so that money will circulate properly. Now, the part we're starting at now is, somebody has to give me the page number, but the subtitle is Bringing Out the Money.
It's page 4. Have you got the printout of the document?
I've got it online, but for Wendell or somebody who's
exciting
with us.
In the PDF file, it's page 8.
Page 8 in the PDF. There you go.
It's numbered page 4, but it's that's the original page number when it was first printed.
Right.
Should we work with original? I'm working with original page numbers, but I can... Which one?
Just add 4 is all you got to do.
Okay, I'm going to start adding 4 then.
Add 4
to get PDF. Everybody to the subtitle, Bringing Out the Money?
Yeah.
Yes.
Right, so the first paragraph there says that the current way there in the 1940s of trying to start money into circulation, so the only current ways that they had were through taxation and government borrowing. And that first paragraph says that, well, taxation is inadequate and borrowing ultimately is self-destructive because of the interest burden that will grow. The growth in the national deficit. Then the second paragraph is kind of the heart of the introduction to the main argument here. It says the sound method of drawing money from the capital reservoir is by the annual production and sale of goods and services, that is by earning it. Then it goes on to use a bushel of corn as kind of an analogy, as an example, to show how, if that bushel of corn is fairly paid, the money that farmer receives recirculates through the economy in such a way that it finances the processing, the distributing, and the purchasing of the product that will be made from that corn. And then it makes a little comparison, what if it weren't properly paid, if it were only paid at half, at 40 cents instead of 80 cents, for example. And it goes into a little bit of detail on that. Then we come to the subtitle, Relationship of Income Groups. And I understood part of this, but I did get a little confused about part of it, too. I understand the argument that they researched figures over several years and found that every dollar that the farmer receives for product, empirically in the economy, ends up being about a dollar too in the labor market. So the labor market and the ag market are kind of one-to-one relationship, and that circulates through the economy to such an extent that the gross national product, is it gross national product?
No,
income.
National income.
The national income is 7 times the amount of that dollar. Is this explanation clear so far?
Mm-hmm. It's 7 times. Every farm dollar creates $7 of national income.
And the key there, really, because nobody understands what we're actually talking about. In fact, this runs very deep in government circles. The reference is the relationship between gross farm income and national income.
Yes. Gross agricultural income and gross national income, the first line of the second paragraph.
That's right. Yep.
So, all right. Now, the part that I'm confused about, and I think we might be able to leave it for later, you all can decide that. I get that relationship between gross agricultural income and gross national income, that it's a 1-to-7 multiplier.
Right.
But then it goes into talking about 7 different economic areas.
Groups.
And saying a similar definite relationship ratio exists between all materials. Well, no, that 1-to-5, that's different. I understand that. That's back to the 1-to gross national income. But this isn't about the groups here, the agriculture, manufacturing, consumer. That left me confused. I am willing to just leave it alone and, or come back later, or if you all prefer to let Randy explain that to us right now, that'd be okay too.
Well, there's a real easy way to do that. Let me look back.
Is it a coincidence that that is also 1-to-7, or is that...
No. If you're looking at the thing on your computer screen, go back up to the page 3 of the PDF, the green cover where it says prosperity is within our grasp.
Yeah.
And you'll see the gears there. One of the gears is farm, and read off the other 6 inside the big gear.
Well, yeah.
That's what he's talking about. Manufacturing, trade and service, finances, utilities and construction, automobiles and service, government, transportation.
Yeah, so
that's
those,
all he's talking about is those 6 that, inside the big gear and the farm inside the little gear. That's all that paragraph is referring to.
What?
Those 6 strike me as arbitrary, and I do not understand where they come from or what they're about, and I think maybe it's not important that I should understand them. Now, Stephen wants to say something, and Susan wants to say something. First, Stephen, please.
Just to go back on 2 things. I agree with you, Mary, that it's sort of arbitrary, and it's just, the divisions of how this Charles C. Ray made his divisions at that time. We might make them a little bit different today, and I don't worry about it, and I don't see you as worrying about it either. I don't think you need to worry about it. The only other point I wanted to make, the key point about that, for us who are...
Can you talk into your phone a little better?
Oh, yeah. For us now who are not used to gears, in that it is that small gear in this case. It's the small gear that's turning the big gear.
The driver. And I get that.
Yeah, that small gear is the driver, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, that's all I'm saying.
Okay, 2?
Well, 2 things. I think it is important to understand those groupings, especially if we're going to be talking with current day people. That was my first point. And I don't know how an economy works. Anyway, the second thing is, why does one of the groupings say transportation and mining? I thought mining was part of the raw materials.
How did construction get stuck in with finance and utilities? So maybe Randy understands.
Well, for one thing, I can't explain why mining is in there, other than that somebody other than Charles B. Ray drew the picture of the gears.
Uh-huh.
That's for one thing. I don't know who drew the picture. I agree with you that the grouping of the 6 items within the big gear are arbitrary, because essentially what's being written here says Charles Ray of Chicago has checked this ratio by using the net cash agricultural income as compared to the net earned national income, and says that he obtains the same ratio 1 to 7, and it's just that Ray identified the seven parts.
Yeah.
In other words,
okay,
Charles Ray did this grouping by the way, and that was just the way that Charles B. Ray did it. That's really what that paragraph means.
Okay. Do you think it's key to the argument we're going to make here, and is it the pamphlet is going to make, or is it a kind of a side argument that we can afford to
I don't think it's all that important, other than if you're going to use the gears, you may want to have something to say about the gears, you know, that's as far as a logo or a meme goes.
Right. Okay. All right.
That's about it.
At some point, someone may have to study Charles B. Ray a little bit, and
that's
maybe
tough, because Charles B. Ray shows up. Chuck Walters, when he wrote Unforgiven, tried to do the research on Charles B. Ray himself and his work, and could find nothing.
Wow.
Nothing.
Oh, my goodness.
Not even a family. Polyglind were the exhibits that Ray prepared for Wilkin and during the congressional presentations.
Oh.
Wow. That's weird.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Well, then for now, for the moment, let's let that go and continue with this, the main argument here, which is shown in the graph in the next page, pretty clearly showing the figures from 1921 through 1937 and preliminary for 38, three columns, the gross agricultural income in millions, the factory gross payroll, and in every year, those are fairly similar, which, you know, they're making the argument that it's a one-to-one relationship, and this shows it to be so. And the national income is about seven times those numbers in each case. Pick any year you like and calculate it out. And it's easy to get the argument they're making. It's very clear. I mean, how can you argue with that?
Right.
So, Sue Stack.
Go ahead, Sue.
So, from this statistical record, basically you can say that it's a one-to-one between agricultural gross income and gross payrolls of factories? Would that be true today?
Not at all. That's the way it was working.
Yeah.
Before they got parity, and I think that was kind of a goal for keeping that, a goal for using parity, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, it was an effect of parity. In other words, the factory payrolls could not grow beyond the gross agricultural income, other than as a short term, maybe a 1 year. Excess of factory payrolls over gross ag income, and then in the following year it may be a little lower than gross ag income, but there was a back and forth relationship. In other words, gross agricultural income was a limiting factor on factory payroll.
Right. Even before parity, these are the years before the parity system was installed.
Well, it takes you right through the depth of the Depression.
Right. Okay.
Yes, all of those numbers, they were, regardless of whether farmers were receiving parity or not, the gross agricultural income and the factory payrolls were running in lockstep, and the national income was running at a seven times factor above them.
Yes. I get that. Are we all together on this now?
Well, why would it be different today?
Well, we've traded off most of our industrial base, shipped it outside the country.
And the service sector replaces it?
To some degree, yes. And finance as well. We have a lot of people working in the financial sector. That we never had before.
Yeah, very productive sector, very productive.
What did you say?
He's being sarcastic.
The financial sector is very productive. Very productive for their pockets.
Very productive for their own interests, yes.
So what would you? So you can't recreate this type of table, then? Is that what you're saying, Randy?
Well, I don't. I have not. The statistics have changed. In other words, factory payrolls is not, in my knowledge, factory gross payrolls in millions. I don't think that statistic is actually kept under that head. And the other thing is gross agricultural income is never listed in the current statistics as that label. You don't find gross ag income. Or if you do find it, it's always an adjusted figure, either seasonally adjusted, or it also includes all kinds of additional items. They have an item they add into the gross agricultural income as a component called the imputed rental value of farm dwellings. They have the subsidies paid by government. There's just all kinds of things they add into gross agricultural income. And what these guys were looking at was essentially what I use today instead of gross agricultural income. I use a number that is in the statistics called cash receipts from farm marketing.
Hmm.
That's what I use as gross agricultural income.
Is that what from in that one video of with Charles Walters with Lundgren, and I think Lundgren is leading the discussion. What was it at an Acres meeting?
Probably.
And he was talking about the statistics and how they had such trouble wading through all of the,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
garbage.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, the statistics have been polluted and mismanaged or mislabeled, or the methodology has been shifted in order to suit some accounting preference rather than to represent the state of the economy.
Yeah.
Randy, could you just give us the category again, cash for agricultural income today, cash receipts?
Yes, cash receipts from farm marketing is how it's labeled in the USDA statistics.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Now, factory gross payrolls, you'd have to go to, I think you'd have to go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Let's see if I can pull something up here quickly.
It was cash receipts from farm marketing.
Yes.
Labor force statistics. Here's how they report this stuff now out of the Bureau of Department of Labor, U.S. Department of Labor, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's BLS.gov, Bureau of Labor Statistics, BLS. Access to historical data for the tables of the usual weekly earnings of wage and salary workers. You know, so it's not separated out by industrial workers. It's wage and salary workers.
Uh-huh.
You see how they mush stuff together, and then you get median usual weekly earnings, and then they break that down by sex, by quarterly averages, seasonally adjusted. They break out into quartiles, you know, on and on and on. But try and find industrial payrolls. You know, it's just not there.
Yeah.
When I think of parity for the future, and I dream of the future, I dream in part of recreating this, and it would it's it's going to be more than a fresh coat of paint.
That's a good way of putting it.
Sue Stack.
The restoration.
Yeah, the restoration is... We're going to strip it down to the foundation and build,
yeah.
build a new platform up.
Yeah. Can we look now at the caption, the rest of the captions of this chart?
Sue had a comment.
You have more questions?
Yes, I have two related questions. Given going back to a parity price, how would this affect the farm sector in terms of the agribusiness, because it's become such a big part? That's my first question. The second is, what kinds of policies would have to be in place along with this change to bring back the factory payrolls?
Well, for factory payrolls, there's really, other than a sound tariff, a parity tariff policy, nothing would be required to bring it back other than putting the money in at the agricultural level, the first point of sale, because that's, with the money available, people will go to work. People will take the opportunity to work to either create their own business or establish a fill a need, because we're currently importing so much stuff from overseas at such a low price that it has killed off our domestic opportunities. So there's really no additional policy that we'd need to implement, at least in my view. We might find that it's heading in a lopsided direction, and we may need to do something about trying to keep it from going haywire, but I don't see any reason that at the outset we'd need to add any other policy. I'm sorry, what was the first part? That was the second part of your question.
The second part, well, I think you answered it. The first part, hold on, the second part was bringing back the factory payrolls. I think you answered that. And the first part was had to do with the farm parity. I forget. Does anyone remember my first?
There are so few people on the farms now. Before, as part of this multiplier had to do with that there were 54 million people out there earning this money and spreading it around wherever they live. Now there are so few people, and in fact most of the money goes to giant corporations rather than to just people. So the question is, if parity pricing would be reenacted, how will the distribution be, will the distribution still be as helpful as it used to be?
Well, yes, provided that it actually is implemented to deliver the prices to the producers. But I have always said, in the last few years or so, 5 years or 10 years, something like that, I have mentioned the fact that the parity loans, which is how the policy was implemented practically at the farmer level, how it needs to be implemented is that it should be offered on the same crops that we used in the 1947 to 1949 period. In other words, no GMO soybeans, no GMO cotton, none of that stuff. Offer it the parity loan, 90% parity loan, non-recourse loan to the farmer, establishing a floor under the price at the first point of sale, which bypasses agribusiness. In other words, if agribusiness wants some of this, they have to pay that much or a little more before they can get it from the farmer, then it should be on the same crops we produced the last time we had parity, 1952.
But I don't understand, Randy, about agribusiness, how that's structured. I mean, aren't they a farm?
The agribusiness today simply takes advantage of the market prices established through Chicago Mercantile Exchange, New York Mercantile Exchange, you know, wherever they may be, the futures market pricing is a manipulated price, as I said earlier on the earlier phone call, over fictitious quantities of the commodities. And the agribusiness takes advantage of picking up the production at those artificially depressed prices in order to make their margins and make their money. So if they have to pay the parity price, or a little better, in order to get a hold of production, then that just simply eats into their margin. If they want to add more cost and keep their margin where it is now, what they will find coming out the other end is a bunch of angry consumers.
But I don't understand. I thought agribusiness are these huge farms with hundreds of thousands of chickens on them.
Well, okay, here's the thing then. What I'm talking about as far as a parity loan is on five basic storable commodities. Not meat, not dairy.
Uh-huh.
Randy, so I understand, if I haven't got it right, I'm understanding you to be saying that agribusiness are mostly buyers who would be paying parity prices to quote-unquote regular farmers.
Right.
I, like you, had the idea that agribusiness were huge volume producers, even of, for example, corn, wheat, soybeans, cotton. And they're not really producers, they're only commodities, they're only commodity buyers. I'm a little confused on that.
Well, Wendell, you still on? Unmute your phone.
I just put on the side here, don't say I think. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
How many what you would call agribusiness producers are farming ground in your area?
I don't know of any agribusiness. When I think of agribusiness where I'm at, I'm thinking about the people we go to for inputs, seeds,
fertilizers.
Now, you go to an individual farm, and this is like been brought out in the norm call, you're going to find that a lot of them may have LLC, Limited Liability Corporation, or something like that after their name. But that is for tax purposes and legal purposes, insurance protection and like that. But they are actually run by family members. The agribusiness, this is how I say it on the norm call, and I think Randy's tried to correct me a little bit, but I'll say it again just to throw it out for you. I call agribusiness the point at which they say, this is our price for our product. Take it or leave it. We as producers of our agricultural materials go to this bogus type market, the mercantile, and say, what do you give me today or at this moment? We are price takers, not price setters or makers. They are.
Interesting.
Does that help clarify the perceptions anyway?
A little bit. We'll probably fall right back perceptions, but...
Yeah, well, I hear you. It is a... There's lots and lots of points of view involved here. And so when people talk about agribusiness, most of the agribusiness fortunes or large corps that have been built up have either been in the grain trade, buying grain and shipping grain, or they've been in the seed and chemical business, as a provider of seed stock and soil treatments.
Right.
Now
they're involved in those concentrated animal feeding operations too, right? Those big, huge.
Yep.
So I appreciate Wendell's point of view on this and the idea, because this is an old idea for me.
that farmers, real farmers, producers, seems like have always been subject to arbitrary pricing. Any manufacturer or producer of some other product sets the price on their product to sell. But farmers are always like, oh, what are you giving me?
That's
so
right.
I wonder if you both will agree that that's a way for us to distinguish in our minds between producers or farmers on the one hand and agribusiness on the other hand, people who are setting the prices or people who are subject to arbitrary prices. Then we could look at CAFOs that Jerry mentioned, these animal and dairy things, mm-hmm. and see, which side of that are they on? Are they setting their prices or are they stuck with somebody else's prices? Now,
exactly.
I think that's good.
I think that's valid.
Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times they're part of the entire system.
You bet.
They work both ways of production, you know.
Sure.
And they've got huge conglomerates that own those, international conglomerates that own those things.
Which means,
of
course...
So do they set their prices?
Well, see, that's where the difficulty comes in, is trying to figure that out, because they have access, if they are a part of a large conglomerate, they can become the loss leader. In other words, they can become the sinkhole for tax liability keeping the price and the earnings low, and forcing other private farmers, smaller farmers, out of business because they suck up the tax advantages of the large corp that's making money off of money.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
It gets really complicated and deep, doesn't it? And dark.
Very dark. Yeah. Again, it's geared towards manufacturing a hokum product down to a price, keeping the margin as large as possible and cheating your consumers. And it's unsound, and we cannot stand it any longer.
No, for sure.
It's ruining our economy. It's ruining our communities. It's ruining our health. It's ruining our government. And it's already ruined our money.
This is Sue. Yes, but I have another question based on just this last piece here that we're talking about. So, the agribusinesses, if we could identify, I don't know if we can, but say, for example, suppose we could identify the top 10 agribusinesses in the United States. And if we analyze their balance sheet, would they be dependent on the banks for loans?
Yeah. I think Bill Heffernan has already done that research at University of Missouri. That's Heffernan, H-E-F-F-E-R-N-A-N. That's Nancy Alpha Nancy Heffernan. Bill or William Heffernan. He was studying concentration in agribusiness or ag-related corporate enterprise.
University of Missouri?
Yeah.
At what time period?
Oh, mid-90s to early 2000s, I think.
Wow. Is he a Norm guy?
Well, he was a good friend of Norm. He didn't really have or take a position on parity, but he was certainly interested in the economics and how it was being ruined, how the economics of farming were being ruined by the extraordinary concentration in ownership of what they called vertical integration, is what they called it then.
Right.
In other words, the company that owns the production, the processing, the marketing, the distribution, and the consumer outlet.
That's a nice thing.
Yeah, okay.
I have a book with him in it, William Heffernan, in this book. Maybe you know it, Randy. The Corporate Reapers, The Book of Agribusiness?
Yeah.
It was published like in 1992 or something, but it's huge. It's like a compendium of facts and figures. It's got Charles Walters, Carl Wilkin, Carl Wilkin's associate Vince Rossiter in that, and then just bunches of information. Obviously, Heffernan is in that too, so that's kind of interesting. It's not in print anymore. You have to get used, and it's not online. You have to get used copies of it.
Right.
Interesting. I just started dipping into it, but it's...
Yeah. Well,
what I was getting at there was that I think from his listings there, you can get at least not too old, a list of the largest firms.
Yes, and, you know, it's interesting because I always ask that question because, what was her name? Jean. She was a farmer upstate. She was... Giblet, yeah, and she worked for a multinational French bank here in New York for 10 years, and she said the smallest loan that bank made was $1 billion with a B for boy, $1 billion, and that those loans were rolled over constantly because those businesses, those corporations, were so dependent on those loans, they had to roll them over, which meant that the marketing managers at the bank and the CEOs of those corporations would just make money over rolling over the loans all the time, you know.
Why use your own money when you can use other people's money?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Randy, you mentioned, I was just keeping notes, and you mentioned agricultural business, and you said there were maybe two business areas. One was seed and chemical business, soil treatment,
right.
And the first one was, can you say that one again?
It was
grain dealer?
Grain marketing, grain buyers and shippers, yep. Yeah, like Cargill.
Okay.
That's where Cargill started. As at one point, that was the largest private corporation in the world.
Did we?
Yeah.
No. May still be far as I know. I don't know.
That was one of the ones in that book, Merchants of Grain.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was all those. I think it was five companies he talked about in that thing.
Cargill, Louis Dreyfus, Bungie Beach. ADM. What was the other one?
Yeah, I can't remember. Some of the ways they operated it was really interesting. Mostly in secret, you know, you couldn't get through to interview the Cargills, the actual owners of these companies.
True. Yep. Yeah, it's a private corporation. Yep. Not a stock holding corporation, at least not publicly held stock.
Randy, one more quick question. For meat and dairy people or farmers or dairymen, is there like a second tier, a second level? And since they're, you know, those animals use the grain, you don't put them into your statistics, so you don't worry about them so much?
Ideally, they wouldn't be using the grain. That's the ideal. We don't need animals eating grain. We don't need people eating grain either, other than that, we're going to do it. But animals should be fed, chickens, I guess, but cattle should not be eating grain.
No, hogs eat corn. In fact, at one time, the USDA considered making hogs and corn.
Didn't they have that on that in the parity bill? Hogs and
corn.
Some poultry.
Well, there's the parity list extends to 100 items or more, but the bulk of agricultural income depends on the bulk agricultural production. And that is the bulk of the income and the bulk of the pounds, weight, hundredweight, whatever it is, of agricultural production is essentially in five storable commodities. And the point is, once you've stabilized that portion of agricultural income, all the other parts and pieces of agriculture will find their own relationship, their own balanced relationship to the bulk.
So what you're saying is really, you don't. Your proposition is just to put parity prices for those five crops.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Corn, soybean, cotton, wheat, and barley. Okay, thank you.
And it's because they're the bulk of the income, agriculture income. That's why.
They're the bulk of the production.
Production.
Did you say income, but we're measuring production by?
It's production.
Production by bushels, by quantity.
Volume.
Yep.
Not most ag income, but most ag, the ag, biggest ag volume.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
You sound a little far away from the phone, Mary.
Me?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll get close. I gotta make a note. Are we ready to move on?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, so the rest of this caption goes into a little bit more detail about the 1 to 5, if you count other other raw materials besides just agriculture, and then it makes a comment about a comparison of how much money there would have been in the economy from 30 to 38 if the right prices had been used. And then we get to a question that's going to lead us into what I think is going to be the heart of the whole rest of this conversation, is where does the economy begin? Does national income come first or factory payrolls come first? Evidently, and I think it's true, there are people who will argue both of those. And but this, we're arguing that agricultural income starts the procession, is naturally first. And so then we go into this next subtitle, prosperity starts on the farm, where they begin to detail why they say that. And the first reason is, the records clearly show that that agricultural income leads factory payrolls and as a yardstick of, what the statistics of payrolls going up and down, that comes behind the statistics of agricultural income going up and down. Statistically, farm income leads. That's the first point. And then it goes into the second point, which has four subpoints. And I think it's too bad the way it's written, because common sense and logic have been so abused and exploited that we're very suspicious. But they go right in saying common sense and logic should prove. That's a little bit unfortunate, but they follow it up with some serious arguments. The first argument is that farm products amount to 70% of all the raw materials or new wealth produced each year. Now, that is heavy. Mm-hmm. 70% of all the new wealth every year is farm products? You can't argue with that. And their second point is, you don't have to worry about demand like with some other industries where, oh, people may not want it. No. People want food all the time. So it's a huge amount of the actual productivity, the actual material produced every year, and there's a constant demand not to worry. And then we get to this third point about how at that time in 1940, there were 54 million people living on farms. And when they had buying power, then the buying power, that helped the buying power to multiply 7 times. Because it was all over everywhere. Now, I'm going to have questions for Randy about how different that might be now, that there are only maybe 4 million people living on farms, and so many farm communities have already died. But anyway, so that's the third point. And the fourth one is that even when, let's see, I'm going to read it because it's short. Farm labor and plants which process farm products show only a slight decline in employment when agricultural prices fall. For example, flour production and meat slaughter in 1932, almost the same as in 1929 when before the crash. While the production of automobiles dropped tremendously, like about to a quarter, almost a quarter of what it used to be. So farm labor and products continue to work. I think that means that if they are properly paid, they represent a leveling of economic trends.
Stabilizing.
All that work still has to be done. What did you say?
Stabilizing. Yeah.
Stabilizing. There you go. A stabilizing effect.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the four main reasons they're giving here when they say logic and common sense. But, well, they are common sense in my view. Then they go back to the bushel of corn analogy and take it a couple steps farther. That if you pay the corn at 80 cents, which at that time seemed a good price, maybe it does not, so I don't know, then it talks about how much money that puts into the economy. And if you only pay it at 40 cents, if you cheat the farmers, than how much less money there is for the whole rest of the economy. The last paragraph here, at 40 cents a bushel for corn, farm income drops from that source to only $1
trillion.
Factory payroll is only $1 trillion. Previously, it was $2.5 trillion.
Now those are billions.
Bushels.
Those are billions, not trillions.
Billions, oh my God. Thank you. Sorry. My family has laughed at me for a long time about having trouble with zero.
I hear you.
It's the shortcoming I live with. Okay, so... So at 40 cents a bushel, income drops from that source to $1 billion. Factory payroll to just $1 billion, and national income to $7 billion, which is a loss of $7 billion as compared to selling the corn at 80 cents per bushel. So those four points, are they as strong and impactful to you all listening as they were for me?
I think you brought them out really good.
Why the economy has to start, obviously does start, not has to start, but obviously does start with the farm.
I like that simple word. We have a constant tummy urge.
It's pretty straightforward.
And even though they use a meat product, I sort of understand why they do that. But a beefsteak cannot be consumed more than once. And just to keep it on a grain base, I was going to use oats. Oatmeal can't be eaten more than once either, I hope, unless by a pig.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Eva, for bringing that up. Part of the first point was not only that it's 70% of the wealth, but that it's perishable and every year needs to be reproduced. I'm sorry, I forgot to say that.
Yeah,
consumed only once.
Right. Well, are you ready to pass the baton off?
I am. I have a question pending. It doesn't have to be answered now. But
no, go ahead.
I think I have the idea that there are still people nowadays, maybe even dominant sources, who would argue that no, the first thing is the money, is the chicken or the egg and whatnot. The first is the money. And I wonder, I'm a little curious, mildly curious, what arguments they would use against this strong argument, if they have anything at all. How does somebody try to argue that the money has to come first?
Well, it goes back to, excuse me, it goes back to, well, that belief has been around for a very long time. It has to do with capital and labor.
Yeah.
Some people believe that capital is the only way you can put labor to work. If you don't have capital, you cannot employ labor. That's the primary argument.
Okay, thank you.
What they fail to realize, of course, is that capital cannot exist unless labor first creates it.
And it also ignores the idea that if, for example, there's a big collapse, which there could be,
mm-hmm.
some huge real collapse of everything, people will work to try to produce their own food, money or no money.
That's right. You can't eat money and be well nourished.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you.
Another one I like to use when I hear people say such things is, okay, I guess I was mistaken then. You must be telling me that when civilization first began, it began because God loaned us the money to start.
Okay, I like that. That's helpful.
So, question. This is a question. So, this is my question. This whole just let me say, I never studied economics. Okay, so this whole thing of capital and labor. So you have the laborer, and he earns more than he's needing for his day-to-day existence, and he saves it, and that becomes capital. But we live with vast pools of capital not owned by labor.
So far.
Yeah.
His savings is not capital. It's just saving.
Mm.
The only time it becomes capital is when he puts that money to work, or that savings to work. When he applies that savings to a new tool, or a new building, or a new animal, a piece of livestock, you know, you have to do something with that savings in order for it to become capital.
And what's the definition of capital then?
It's their use.
Capital is the build up of an energy that can be used to increase your productive capabilities.
Hmm. That's an interesting definition.
But capital can only be considered capital when it is being used. That's the key element.
Hmm.
Savings just laying around is that's what these guys really refer to as the capital pool or the capital reservoir. It's just money laying around. It's either being saved under your name because you've earned it, or it's being unused in a circulating medium of money because it's still sitting in the national reservoir of, we have, in other words, we've created more money than we need to circulate. And so it's sitting in reserve somewhere. I would classify them as reserve dollars or unused circulating coins.
So, Randy, your definition of capital says that it's in the form of money. Way back in 1900, capital was considered things, right?
I don't necessarily say it's money. It's counted in terms of money. Money, the unit of purchasing power, is used to quantify capital. But capital
can be tools.
Capital is not money.
It can be used to purchase.
It's no different than going into the grocery store. Let's assume that you have a silver dollar in your pocket and that milk costs $1 per gallon. You walk into the store with a silver dollar in your pocket looking for milk. You find a gallon jug of milk in the cooler. You grab the milk. You walk to the checkout counter. If you don't deposit your silver dollar before you walk out the door, alarms go off, and you are considered a thief. You must exchange the money for the wealth, or you are a thief. What do you want? Do you want the wealth or do you want the money? You can't get the wealth without exchanging the money. So it's an exchange. It works the same from both directions, and you have to have both directions. The money buys the milk. The milk buys the money. That's what we talk about. That's what I talk about when I say that it's the wealth establishes the value, the purchasing power of the money.
I don't buy the milk. I need the milk.
Capital is just a tool. It's a tool to increase our ability to make more or make better or include more people, make more jobs or whatever. I mean, that's capital is a build-up over time. It's the incremental increase of our ability to control our environment, to produce better housing, better clothes, better food, better education. Labor produces capital. Say again?
Don't financiers also produce capital?
They think they do.
Yeah.
They believe it.
So, like, they produce money and call it capital.
But they're
puts that money to work as if it were capital.
They're chiselers. They're cheaters. They have a franchise for counterfeiting.
Do they know it? Do they know that, Randy?
You bet your buttons they know it.
Wow.
That's why they are not about to give it up.
Right. That's for sure.
Particularly when we say, oh, we see you cheating over there. Stop that. And they say, make me.
Very good, thank you.
So, Sue, on my last question, I don't know. Okay, so, everybody I know, my friends here in New York, they say we live in capitalism. They don't like it. It doesn't make them feel good. They feel like they don't have a voice. They notice what all the financiers here on Wall Street are doing, that kind of thing. So in terms of a definition, given we're talking about capital and talking about capitalism, in my head, I think, well, there's the small capitalist. You know, we want to spread the wealth to as many people as possible, right? And then there's the monopoly capitalists, which have bought up all of these resources.
They've decreased the purchasing power of the money to the point where everybody else is living on the scraps that are falling off their table, while they get to make the printing presses run wide open for as long as they want and spend it first. You know, the advantage always accrues to the fake money creator, to those who spend it first. And they are the ones who get to do that because they have the monopoly on, or the franchise on, the creation of the money.
Yeah, you're reminding me of what Howard Schweitzer says, that you can't really call him a capitalist, the guy who has a pickup truck and a cow.
he's not the guy you're busy hating on. The only true capitalists nowadays are the money manufacturers, the bankers who can create money.
See, I disagree with that. I'd say that they're false capitalists. Those are the international finance capitalists who are cheating all the rest of society in order to make their magic game work.
And they've been around for a really long time.
And it's up to us to finally wake up and say, we've had enough, thank you. We are going to stop doing that.
Gotcha.
And we're going to stop allowing you to do that. We're going to reform our money. We're going to pay people who are worthy of their hire a proper price so that all of us are well paid and we can all move forward together. Instead of having you guys tell us how many steps we can take forward or back.
So let's go back to Sue's question for a minute. We feel like we live in capitalism and there's a few capitalists taking advantage of us all and we hate it.
Mm-hmm.
That's those bankers right there, is that right?
Well, it's actually us. And because we don't understand what is happening to us, we are subject to their manipulation.
Okay.
It's our fault. It falls squarely on our soldiers, our shoulders. It is us. And if it takes it, then we have to be able to even resolve ourselves to saying, okay, then fine. We're going to start our own community, and we're going to produce our own stuff, and we're going to separate ourselves from you cheating, chiseling SOBs. And we're going to start again over here, and you are not going to be allowed to play with us.
There's places like that are already starting.
Trying to find out what the rules are for a good game to proceed, a good relationship to develop out of that, how we need to operate a sound money system, a sound economic production system, so that nobody gets left out, everybody's included, and what sort of behaviors can be tolerated and what cannot be tolerated is a challenge.
Yep.
And I will suggest the first rule. Number one,
okay.
Right at the top, no one may profit at the expense of another.
What other rules could there be? That sounds like that's about it.
Oh, I got some more for
her. Oh, you do? You got a list?
I got eight more if you want to hear them.
Oh, okay.
Number two, no one nor the government may take anything from a person or another nation by force. Three.
We're copying these down. You got to go slow.
All natural resources.
What? You're going too fast, Randy. Who's taking notes?
I am, and it's being recorded.
It's being recorded. You can go back.
Oh, okay. Are you going to type them up, Stephen?
No, you know what? I
can send these around to you. I've got them all typed up.
Thank you.
That would be appreciative.
Three, all natural resources shall belong to the commonwealth of all citizens and shall not be owned by any person or corporation of persons.
You sound like an indigenous person, Randy.
All natural resources.
The great commons.
Four, every citizen is due equal education and the freedom to choose his vocation, and he has equal rights before the law.
Well, how did that start?
Every citizen is due equal education.
Oh, due. Okay.
And the freedom to choose his vocation. And he has equal rights before the law. Five, all promotions shall be based only upon personal merit and proficiency. Six, everyone must compensate fully for every personal possession he receives and hopes to retain. See, this is where we run off base here, is because people have acquired way too much stuff that they haven't really compensated fully for.
Mm-hmm.
And so we wind up with people in our community who owe such a huge debt back to the community that they can never repay it in a lifetime. That ruins a community. And the community can't tolerate such imbalance. It's bad for the person who owes it, as well as the community who allowed him to get in that condition.
Mm.
Seven, no person nor the government may operate in the environment of another unless specifically requested to do so by that person. The government, however, may enforce the law in treasonable, criminal, and civil suits. Eight, no one may kill or injure another except in the defense of his life or his state.
State?
State, yeah.
Oh. So where
state are with a small s.
Oh.
Nine, the sanctity of the home is inviolate.
Wow.
Those are all natural laws.
Did you make them up,
or where did these come from?
No, those are known as the Ten Lemurian Laws. Well,
oh.
Nine of them. There's a ten.
Going to send them around to us?
I can, if you'd like.
Yeah.
And the tenth one is a little odd. It says, if no violation of natural law, that's what all those nine are. If no violation of natural law is involved, the majority rule will apply and will be subject to approval of the Brotherhood's direct representatives whose decisions will be final.
So I look forward to contemplating those some more.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
You know. This
right.
Lemuria, by the way, is a civilization that, well, all of us spent time there, actually. But, and in fact, it's our nascent memories of having lived there for as long as we did that incline us to think that there's something better.
Hmm.
But about 75,000 years ago, that civilization began, and it lasted for 50,000 years by following these laws.
Wow.
How do you spell that?
Lemuria?
Yeah.
U-R-I-A.
L-E what?
M, as in Mike.
Right, you are?
U-R-I-A, yes, Lemuria.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially,
yeah.
It's a tectonic plate that currently is the bottom of the Pacific Ocean.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I remember, I think a long time ago I heard of that, but where's your source? I mean, how...
you can pick up old copies of the book, I think. It's called The Ultimate Frontier.
Oh, okay. Hmm.
You can still buy it. I think they've produced new copies of it, but the ones that I've... the one I've got is, I think, like a 1980 copy or something, somewhere in there. The more recent ones have been edited and changed, and I haven't read them, so I can't tell you, but the one I've got is called The Ultimate Frontiers. They're written by Eklav Kwestner, is the author's name.
What was the name?
K-U-E-S-H-A-N-A, Eklav Kwestner. Eklav, first name. E-K-L-A-L, first name. Eklav Kwestner, K-U-E-S-H-A-N-A. Eklav Kwestner. That's actually a, well, you'll find out. If you read the book, if you get the book and read the book, you'll find out what it means.
Very interesting.
Yeah, but that civilization was, you know, it lasted for 50,000 years, and it did fall apart. It fell apart after 50,000 years. I was going to look this up and see what the copyright date is in this copy here, but I actually have an autographed copy, 1963, yeah.
63?
63, yeah. This was the fifth printing of 1982. But they're in there. It's the... yeah, that book's got a lot of stuff in it. It's a pretty meaty thing as well.
Yes.
I don't want you to fall down.
It describes the universe and what human beings
are. That we went off into that?
Things like that. But we're all, what it comes down to is that it's just, you know, it's human beings. What are we here for? What are we trying to do? Where are we headed? What's the point?
Yep.
What is the point?
It's all tied together.
And the point is that we're trying to learn how to deal with all the stuff we face and deal with it successfully so that it doesn't kill us and it doesn't make us angry.
It's a map.
And we can face it and handle it and do well by it and increase the satisfaction of us and our family and friends and community.
You try to live happily ever after.
Well, I try to live well.
Yes.
Yes. Try to live well as we can. And we lose sight of that because we keep rushing after this or that, money or what we term wealth or things or materialism or all this kind of stuff, and we get lost in all that stuff.
Sometimes with young students, maybe like fifth graders or so, we'll have our sixth graders, and it can vary from fourth to eighth too, and we'll get into these conversations about the, you know, the bigger picture and
right,
the universe and where we're going. And I have a few thoughts on it too, but I'll share some other time. But how I work with kids on that, and I get to a good place between either religious or scientific thinking, we can get to about the same place. And
exactly.
And the kids are pretty much happy with that too.
Sure. Yep. Yeah, kids are they're human beings in immature bodies. I mean, we've been through this a long time and time and time again.
Yep.
We're a slow, stiff-necked group is what we are on this. We really are. Stiff-necked is an understatement. We have been so slow to get with the program that it's an embarrassment, really.
What Thomas Edison said, if we really understood, we'd throw the rascals out by the morning. He wasn't planning to be stiff-necked.
So that was Ford said that.
Oh, Ford. Ford, sorry.
Bankers, yeah.
Edison had a word in two, but...
Yeah, I think there was two people that said similar things. Because I remember some...
Are we going to move on
it's 9 o'clock, and I can push on fast and furious, basically. You know, it's a lot of what we just covered. We're gonna get more into Mary's part, and then we're going to get into the hokum about money on the next page. So we can cover it now, but I don't know. It's maybe a long night for some people. What do we think? What's best?
I'm okay.
I'm good. It's 9 o'clock for me.
It's getting a little late for me in New York.
Yeah, we've been on for an hour, so.
It's
been very productive already, in my view.
Right. Yes.
Say that again, Mary.
I said this conversation has been very valuable already for me.
And are you ready to take a break, or?
I can go either way.
Well, I think Randy and Sue, and I'm a bit under the weather. I'm happy to take a break. But this next part is ready to go, but I'm happy to do it when we start up next time, too, and I can just try to go fast with it. Let's make a plan that we go, since it covers just actually what we've been talking about here. And, yeah, I won't go into it right now, but it's, you know, it supports what Mary said, and then there's three steps to prosperity, and then it goes into the money question. And I have a sense that maybe we should wait a little bit.
Yeah, it's a lot of information.
And it sounds like Sue needs some time to relax, too.
Yeah, I think we should try and set a date for the next one, unless you want to pick it later.
Yeah, Randy and Joe have to be at that conference. Is that next week?
Yes, and Sue, too.
And Sue, too?
Sue's a discussant, yes.
I am? I didn't. No one told me that.
That's why you just said.
No, nobody told me that. No, I don't think I'm on the list. My name wasn't on that list at the EEA. Jamie never asked me.
Well, there's a document that, let me see if I can dig this up here.
I think I've had that role before the EEA, and basically you have to list, I don't know, maybe I was something else, but either you work on one person's paper or everyone's paper there's a number of talks, and you give like a synopsis and wrap that on some questions or something. It's actually, I don't know if that's the same role, but I had that as you can almost be like a moderator, but you come in at the end and give that talk.
Well, on Friday, March 1st, 1 to 2:20 in the afternoon at the Madison Square room in the New York Hilton. It says Group C17, Money, Power, Politics, Wealth, and Equitable Trade in Economics. Session sponsored by the American Monetary Institute. Session chair, Jamie Walton, American Monetary Institute. Session organizer, Jamie Walton, American Monetary Institute. Understanding the role of money and money contracts in a market economy. Bitcoin is not money. Paul Davidson, University of Tennessee. The case for a fiscal policy substitute managed by the Fed. Nicholas Tiedemann, Virginia Tech. Public money economics, Minsky's post-capitalism solution. Joe Bongiovanni, Kettle Pond Institute. Third parties and monetary reform in U.S. history. Howie Hawkins, 2018 gubernatorial candidate for the state of New York for the Green Party. Economics on the Ground, Wealth, Money, and Equitable Trade, Randy Cook, National Organization for Raw Materials. Discussants, Jamie Walton, American Monetary Institute. Dan Sullivan, Council of Georgist Organizations. Ron Rubin, Henry George School of New York. Alan Smith, Henry George School of New York. Sue Peters, Greens for Monetary Reform.
You're kidding. Hey, well, I'm not alone. That's good. I mean, I got to talk to these guys. No one told me. Nobody.
You've done a poor job of communicating. Yes, we know this. This is, if you go to that website, the EAA, or EEA, excuse me, and look up their document, is the conference handbook is what it is. It's a PDF file. And on page 34 of 141 pages.
Wow.
That's what you find.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned it. At least give me, give me 6 days to worry about it.
Without any communication from Jamie, I've had to dig pretty deeply here to make sure that I know where I'm putting my feet.
Oh, no. By the way,
Jamie has come alive again, so feel
yes,
free
he has.
To communicate uh-huh. with him.
Yep. Yeah, and in fact, I got an email from that Ibrahim guy, Sue, at the George School, who wanted me to send him some information, and I apologize, having been gone, I was gone yesterday and today, down at my brother's place. Today is my birthday, by the way. So.
Oh, happy birthday!
Happy birthday.
I was down there celebrating birthday with part of my family. So, anyway, I haven't responded to his email. He wanted just a short bio and some information. I'm going to have to do it tomorrow. But anyway, I did get a request from him so that he could advertise the session at the George School on Saturday, I believe.
Right. Yeah, he's the.
To that, or whether you're going to that, or what the deal is, but.
Yeah, I'm going to go to hear you at the George School, you and Joe at the George School, too. And Ibrahim's he's the educational director of the Henry George School here in New York, and he's really excited about having both of you. He's really a cool guy. I like him.
Excellent. Good, good.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so I hope he's not getting too anxious about it. I know it's short, and he doesn't have a lot of time to make use of what material I may send him that he's requested, but my apologies for that. But it's just with Jamie being so hard to get a hold of up until this point in time, it's been kind of hit and miss for me.
Right. No, it's understandable.
So should we set a date for the next meeting or next call?
Maybe in two Saturdays.
In two Saturdays, so that would be
Sunday or
Sunday's better for me.
Sunday's better for me too.
March 10th, yeah.
So would that be good?
Okay.
Well, we don't know about Joe, but we could set it tentatively.
Well,
yeah.
It's good for me, and the Sunday after on the 17th. We start going to Spain.
Yeah, Sunday the 10th is okay, right, Steve? I mean, we're not leaving till, yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay,
so we're going to
same time, 6 p.m. or 6 p.m. Central, 7 p.m. Eastern. Oh, no. Wait, that's, I'm sorry, I'm confusing the board meeting.
I think you need to put a few more things on your plate.
Yeah. Jerry, you give the time. I'll go with anything.
I'll just look at what we had before and use the same time. I think it was 6:30 Central, 7:30 Eastern. I'm pretty sure.
No, we pushed it back because I had to do it later.
Yeah, it was.
This is the last time, but you want to do it later still? You still want to? And 8:30 Eastern.
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
All right.
That's March Sunday, and Randy, just real quick, when is the next farmers meeting?
Well, we've been doing that norm call Tuesdays and Saturdays since January of 2000.
Okay. You know what? I'm going to write you a note.
Okay.
I'll put it in. Maybe I'll put it in the letter.
I will make this recording. I will upload it and send Sue a link to it.
Are they going to charge admission?
And you know what?
Well, I could leave it where it's at and send everybody a link, I guess.
And you can, at the same time, send the your rules, the 10 rules.
Yeah, well, you can dig them out for yourself if you want to. I would prefer to do it that way. That way you have to process it through your own fingers and brain.
dig them out from the book or from the norm site?
From the recording.
Oh, okay.
Very good.
I'm devious that way.
Is anybody going to take notes for this meeting or write minutes or whatever
this
for this meeting?
Stephen, I don't think
maybe you should do it. You sort of have a lot to do right now.
Hopefully Jerry's volunteering.
Procession.
Not really, but I mean, I'll do it if I have to. I mean, Mary's a speaker, so she can't really take notes on herself.
Right.
So I guess,
I think since we're covering a working document, I don't even know if notes are needed. No, because basically the most interesting part is the conversation.
Right.
You know,
well, it would be the conversation, not the document. Just like the minutes I sent out before, it was mostly conversation.
Right.
The things we said.
Okay, okay.
Do you want me to include Lee in this, the link to the recording?
Include what?
The new member. You said Lee somebody?
Oh, Lee, Oco, yes, yeah. Include him to send it to him.
Yeah, okay.
Wendell, if he's interested.
Sure. Oh, sure.
Good. So, March 10th, 7:30 Central, 8:30 Eastern. Are we going to use your, go back to your number, Sue, or stay with our, did Sue leave?
No, I'm here. We can, whichever, I mean, we can use my number. Yeah.
Go back to, I don't know, it's six of one, half dozen the other, just so everybody knows what number we're supposed to be. That's why you got to pay attention when the emails come, because I send them both in the reminder and in the beginning what the number is. I just don't have, I can't make yellow marks on my email thing, like you can, Sue.
Why don't we use Randy's number if he's going to be part of the discussions?
Right. Okay, and then I'll send. I'll also send the norm call time for Saturdays, so that'll be in there, just in case anybody can bring make it to that call too. And we're just going to pick up on these last two pages here. Do you think we'll get through those? The next call.
No, we could in theory have done now, but I'll be in good shape next time while we could do it now, but
that's all right. I'm sort of dragging myself, so that's fine. We still have a lot of pages to go through if we're going to finish this whole book. And in between time, we have to figure out how we're going to set up communications with Nick Peterman. So we can worry about that next time, I think. But just be thinking about it.
Well, wait. Well, Sue's going to be seeing Nick. Randy's going to be seeing Nick.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
He's going to initiate by giving the traditional economics argument against parity. But then, as soon as he says that, he's ready, he's open to go in the other direction.
Right, that's what he told me. He would. So we could, what we have to do, I think, is come up with something, he says, I think the last time when I talked to him, he said he'll share, he'd be prepared to send something to us, not 25 books, but, you know, something to start the conversation, and then we...
Okay, I can't stay on any longer. Come and watch the card playing.
This is much more interesting.
This is my second call. I couldn't.